oxygen acidification affects their neurons in a way that maybe they feel more threatened and they prefer to stay more sheltered.
Acidification changes how fish behave in the ocean. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Bethel artists learn to work with an abundant material.
Fish skin is really hot right now as a medium, mainly in Iceland.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Electronic health records free Alaskans from the paper chase by giving doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where they need it. Electronic health records increase safety and security. Electronic records take health information out of the filing cabinet and into the digital light. You can find out more at ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network.
Alaska will lose about 400 soldiers from U.S. Army Alaska operations, and the announcement is being portrayed as good news for military officials in the state. J-Bear spokesman John Pinnell says Anchorage operations will lose 780 positions, but Fort Wainwright will gain 367 for a net loss of around 375 soldiers by the end of 2015. Pinnell says the positions will largely come from cutting smaller units within the 2nd Engineer Brigade.
Others will move to different headquarters within U.S. Army Alaska. For instance, the 6th Engineer Battalion, they are an airborne qualified engineer battalion. They will move to the 425th Airborne Brigade Combat Team and become an engineer battalion within that brigade.
The cuts were not a surprise. They are part of the 80,000 soldier drawdown called for in the Budget Control Act of 2011. But Pinnell says if you consider losses in other parts of the nation, Kentucky's Fort Knox, for example, will lose 3,800 to 4,000 soldiers, an entire brigade combat team. The small cut to Alaska's military positions is good news. Pinnell says the Army values Alaska's strategic position.
Not only for the Arctic, but also for the entire Pacific theater. And so our two brigade combat teams, one here in Anchorage, the airborne team, and one in Fairbanks, the Stryker Brigade team, they are valuable assets in a very strategically valuable location.
Pinnell also stressed that the smaller loss here is a reflection of the strong community support that Alaskans have always shown for the military. He says mostly positions will not be refilled as soldiers rotate out or retire. He says there will be some that will have their tours shortened, but that will be on a case-by-case basis. Sponsors of an initiative to legalize marijuana in Alaska turned in their petition today to the Lieutenant Governor's Office. Initiative sponsor Tim Hintenberger says more than 45,000 Alaskans signed the petition, and he is confident it has the statewide support it needs.
The success of the signature drive was based on Alaskan voters' desire to end marijuana prohibition, and we expect that momentum to carry through to Election Day in August.
Hintenberger says the initiative lays out a regulation plan similar to that of alcohol.
The initiative will replace the failed policy of prohibition in Alaska with a system of regulated production, sales, and it will provide for taxation of sales in a regulated environment of sales that will require consumers to present ID and show proof of age.
The initiative would require buyers to be at least 21 years old. If the Division of Elections certifies the petition, the initiative will appear on the primary election ballot in August. Go to alaskapublic.org for the full text of the initiative. Scientists have been saying for years that more carbon dioxide in the oceans is hurting sea life. But a new study says the impact goes beyond the physical. It says ocean acidification is changing behavior in fish. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek explains, that could be a problem throughout the ecosystem, including for fisheries in Alaska.
Researchers know that ocean acidification can be harmful. The change is caused by an increase in carbon dioxide in ocean water. More CO2 means a more acidic habitat. It can wear away crab shells and fish scales, and it makes it harder for them to grow back. But what about how acidification is making those species feel? Martine Triscaris is a marine biologist based out of the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in California. In a recent study, his team set out to look at what goes on in the brains of juvenile rockfish when they live in acidified waters. He says rockfish have predictable behaviors, so it's easier to see changes happening in what they do.
The normal fish, they're used to moving between the shaded and light parts of the kelp forest, for example, looking for food or interacting with other fish.
They wanted to see whether acidification would make the fish behave differently. To find out, they looked at certain neurons in the fish's brains. Those neurons are known to change what they do when the fish has a high blood acid level. In a previous study on Australian clownfish, the change affected sense of smell. Triscaris says this study was looking at the same neurological process. For their experiment, they took a rockfish that lived in acidified waters and put it in a tank with two different colored walls, one light and one dark. He says the acidified fish wanted to stay by the dark wall, and so did a fish that had been dosed with an anxiety-inducing drug.
Ocean acidification affects their neurons in a way that maybe they feel more threatened and they prefer to stay more sheltered.
It might not sound too significant, but it points to something bigger. Acidification was making the fish do the opposite of what they'd normally do.
Depending on the species, if they normally go offshore at a certain period of time or they might go to a specific area to spawn and reproduce, it might affect the way they interact with other fish. So the potential implications are pretty big.
Triscaris' co-author on the study is Trevor Hamilton, a neuroscientist based out of McEwen University in Edmonton, Canada. He says the changes they saw would be really long-term in the wild. They looked at the kind of acidification that takes place over 100 years. But he says any species of fish in acidified waters is vulnerable to these same effects. Eventually, it could shake up the entire ecosystem.
What could end up happening is the fish will spend less time leaving their safe environment, so there is potential for them to get caught by less nets, essentially, and get eaten by less predators. So it could have an effect all the way up the food chain, as well as for general fishing for humans.
And that's a problem in the Bering Sea. Here and in other places with colder waters, more carbon dioxide gets absorbed into the ocean faster. That means these long-term changes might happen sooner.
So in Alaska, you may see this effect happening a bit sooner, and it may be more pronounced. And that would actually be a really, really interesting question to study, to lower the water temperature and see what the effect would be.
That's part of their next phase of research. Hamilton and Triscaris hope to do more field work after this, and they want to look at how fish might adapt to the effects of acidification, because that could mean behavioral changes too. They call it a domino effect. Hamilton says while this isn't something that'll wipe out any species overnight, it's important for fishermen and regulators to be aware of.
If this mechanism does actually occur in the future, we will see fish that are more likely to stay closer to their home environment and explore different situations a lot less. We don't know if it will happen, but it's something we should definitely be concerned about.
Hamilton says they picked rockfish for their first study in part because the species is harvested commercially. He says if ocean acidification continues at its current rate, fishermen may see fish acting differently than they're used to, and they may see fewer fish where they usually expect to find them. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look back at Holly Brook's unusual transition from coach to Olympic athlete.
You know, there were a lot of people that told me, oh, with your background, you can never do this, or you're too old, the U.S. ski team will never nominate you.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com.
What should have been a routine meeting of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly and the borough's Fish and Wildlife Commission took a political turn last night. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, it seems the borough mayor and the commission members have a distinct difference of opinion when it comes to divisive state legislation.
The Mat-Su Barrows Fish and Wildlife Commission has been working to bring back the area's diminished salmon runs. According to Commission member Howard Delo, 7 of the State Board of Fish's 10 stocks of concern are Mat-Su salmon stocks. Diminishing salmon returns, especially of Chinook and Coho salmon, are hurting the borough's once lucrative sport fishing economy. At Tuesday night's joint Mat-Su Assembly and Fish and Wildlife Commission meeting, Delo outlined the Commission's priorities for spending the legislative funding available to the borough for fisheries research.
I would say the most important fish economically to the borough are silvers, cohos. And quite frankly, with that drop in angler days, people are not coming to the borough to fish like they used to 5 years ago.
Delo says the commission wants the state's fisheries board to authorize changes to the Northern District Salmon Management Plan so it focuses less on commercial interests in order to provide more fish for sports fishers upstream.
The driftleet is the big commercial group that intercepts northernbound fish.
Larry Engel, interim chair of the commission, told the assembly that funding for continued genetic research is essential for next year's budget request. Engel wants a genetic identification program for coho salmon since there is so little information on coho in the Northern District. The dialogue continued, covering hatcheries, habitat, even problems with northern pike, but it took a sharp turn when Assemblyman Jim Sykes brought up a letter signed by Engel that the commission had sent directly to Governor Sean Parnell. Engel's December letter addressed concerns the commission has with a controversial proposed bill that restricts applications for in-stream flow reservations in salmon creeks. The letter states, quote, "Eliminating the ability of private partners to participate in fisheries stewardship will not benefit our fisheries," and it asks the governor to withdraw his bill. But a week later, Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss fired off his own letter to the governor on borough letterhead, applauding the goals of the governor's bill and explaining that the borough assembly had twice voted not to weigh in on the pending legislation. The mayor's letter made former Mat-Su Assemblyman Warren Kehoe angry.
"And Mr. Mayor, not only have you come down squarely on the wrong side of the issue, but you are once again making unauthorized borough policy statements."
Assemblyman Sykes then moved to direct the borough manager to write another letter in support of the commission's view to avoid perception of a conflict within the borough. But that motion was flattened by a later move to postpone any more action on the issue until assembly members can learn more about the governor's legislation. Sykes said afterward he only wants the legislature to know that the assembly supports the position of the commission.
"I was asking here is to support what the work of the Wildlife Commission was. They operate on facts."
Mayor DeVilbiss, for his part, says he thinks that the borough assembly is only aware of one point of view on the proposed legislation.
"It's obviously not the end of the issue because we're going to sit down and get educated on it with DNR.
A workshop has been scheduled so that the borough assembly can meet with the Department of Natural Resources to learn more about the governor's bill. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
There aren't a lot of luxury items that come out of Southwest Alaska, but there is a group of artists working with a product that Alaskans know quite well if they've ever put away fish. As KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, local artists have a chance to learn to work with fish skin and bring it to new audiences and customers.
Fish skin has a long history in Alaska, but you probably haven't seen it in garment form for a while. Fish skin disappeared with the introduction of other types of fabrics like cotton and Gore-Tex, but you should keep an eye out.
Fish skin is really hot right now as a medium, mainly in Iceland. It's become a type of fashion. People are creating garments and spiky 3-inch heels and handbags, as well as home decor, like wallpaper.
Trina Landlord is the executive director of the Alaska Native Arts Foundation, a nonprofit that works to build markets for Alaska Native arts. She points to renewed interest in Alaska, and it makes sense. Fish skins are abundant here, and they're often just thrown away. It makes for a strong and workable material with beautiful scales and the durability of leather. More and more artists have been taking up the medium, and locally, artists have requested training opportunities. The group is putting on a week-long workshop in Bethel the first week of February. It will be taught by Marlene Nielsen, who's Yupik from the Iliamna area, plus Joel Isaac, an Athabaskan artist. Alaska's a natural place for fish skin innovation, and landlord says that people are starting to notice.
People are starting to revive that material, and they're dyeing it, and they're creating like halter dresses as well as corsets. So we're taking that sort of international flair and honing it down and bringing it home to Alaska.
The class aims to help artists learn to both work with the material and make a business of it.
So being able to help artists build skills to market themselves, to also develop business skills, and to really build on the foundation of like their culture in order for them to then promote themselves as entrepreneurs in their art form.
The class is accepting applications. They're looking for artists who are enthusiastic about the opportunity and willing to share that knowledge with others. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Anchorage resident and U.S. ski team member Holly Brooks is in the middle of her World Cup season, and she just made her second Olympic team. 4 years ago, Brooks had just started pursuing her long-shot Olympic dream. Now, as she prepares for Sochi, she's in a very different position with several years of international experience behind her. APRN's Annie Feit has this look at her unusual route to becoming an Olympian.
On a frigid November day at Hatcher Pass, Holly Brooks glides up to a start line.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, go!
This race is just a practice with her Alaska Pacific University teammates. It's a chance for Brooks to test her skills before heading to Europe for the busy World Cup season. Then it will be on to Sochi for the Olympics in February. Brooks is now a seasoned member of the U.S. ski team, but a little more than 4 years ago, she was on the sidelines. On July 4th, 2009, that all changed.
It was actually this really awkward and odd epiphany.
Brooks was competing in Mount Marathon in Seward. She was safely in the lead when she collapsed a few tantalizing blocks from the finish line with extreme dehydration. On a hospital bed covered in dirt and bloody, she couldn't stop thinking about the thrill of the competition.
And just how close I came to winning. It's like it flipped the switch in my mind and my body. And I was laying in the emergency room and I said to myself, I didn't tell anyone, I want to go to the Olympics.
It was an improbable goal. At the time, Brooks was 27, at least a decade older than most cross-country skiers who set their sights on the Olympics. Brooks had done well in the Tour of Anchorage and the Birkebeiner ski race in Wisconsin, but had zero international experience. The games in Vancouver were just 7 months away.
You know, there were a lot of people that told me, oh, with your background, you can never do this, or you're too old. The U.S. ski team will never nominate you. You know, you're past your prime.
But Brooks believed she had a shot, and so did many of the athletes she coached.
I knew Holly was fast.
Don Herring skied for Brooks in high school and in college. He says when the team was training, Coach Brooks was always right there with them.
And it's not like she would stand there on the side of the trail and tell you where to go. She would go ski with you the whole time, and if you did a hard interval set, she might do the whole thing with you. And then, you know, you go home and rest, and meanwhile, Holly has another session to do, and I would assume she did the same thing with them, too.
Brooks pursued her dream with reckless abandon, as she puts it, and it paid off. In 2010, she eked her way onto the Olympic squad. 4 years later, she has a shot at a relay medal in Sochi. Looking back, Brooks says she can't exactly recommend her unusual path to other skiers, but she says her background gives her something many of her younger competitors lack, perspective.
I think everyone has desire, everyone has motivation, but I've done a lot of other things in my life, and I'm really happy to be doing this here and now. And, you know, I am the oldest one on the team. I know that I don't have 10 more years in my career. So there's a certain amount of, I hesitate to call it urgency, but I'm really excited for what's to come.
Let's go, Ollie!
Back at Hatcher Pass, Brooks is rounding the last corner of the race course, eyeing the finish line.
Up, 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 up!
This race may just be for practice, but Brooks doesn't hold anything back. She wins by 3 seconds and finishes exhausted, but with a huge smile on her face. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Sitka's Pacific High School students returned from winter break yesterday to find one last holiday gift, a new school. For the past 2 years, Pacific High has been housed in the Southeast Alaska Career Center while the Lincoln Street building was remodeled from the ground up. KCAW's Emily Foreman visited the all-new Pacific High the day before students arrived and learned how this state-of-the-art facility has been over a century in the making.
It's the first full week of the new year. Resolutions are fresh, and we're still optimistic that they'll stick. It's a time focused on new beginnings, and Sitka's Pacific High School is honoring that sentiment in a big way with a brand new building.
So here I am. This is the new building.
New building. I know. It looks great, doesn't it? Hard to see on the radio.
Describe it.
Looking from the office, you get this great rotunda, which has this light from the sky coming down in this like scoop. So we have this great space where everybody can meet and gather. That's my favorite spot.
If it sounds quiet for 11:30 a.m. on a Monday, that's because the students are still on break. When I ask Phil Burdick, co-principal of Pacific High, about how the renovation came to fruition, he starts from the beginning, the very beginning, all the way back to the late 1800s.
Education was segregated for a long time in Sitka, and this place that we sit now was a part of that history. This site has gone through many, many incarnations.
Tracking the history is a little murky, but the point is that for well over 100 years, the Lincoln Street site has been dedicated to education. And today's version is worlds away from the original, a one-room, segregated Native training school. Burdick is confident that the current iteration is the best.
So are there ways in which the curriculum will be able to be expanded because of the space?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you look around, every classroom has a door to the outside, which ties into our model that, you know, learning happens out in the community. It doesn't have to happen in the school. So everyone has an opportunity to get out. Everyone has an opportunity to find a quiet space. Everyone has an opportunity to learn in the way in which suits them best.
This building is all about options. For instance, Burdick loves the flex room, a room flanked on either side by large glass doors that lead to two additional classrooms. The doors slide open, transforming what was three separate rooms into a large open space.
My name is Mandy Summer, and I teach English and health.
Summer says that the space is a huge luxury. It's roomy compared to the career center where teachers had to share classrooms. Once Summer started listing the new perks, it was hard to stop.
It's nice to have sinks in our room. I mean, just, you know, I mean, the little things, you know, that you don't really realize. And it's just new, you know. I mean, I have only worked here with the ceiling dripping on me and, you know, moldy tiles above my head. And, you know, I mean, that's the only Pacific High I've ever known. So this is really nice.
Hillary Seelan teaches English, history, and government, and really appreciates her large windows overlooking Crescent Harbor.
And, you know, the windows are really lovely. I love all the light in here. I love the color palette in here. I like all the storage.
Look at your view. Like,
I know, right?
How many teachers have this kind of view?
No one.
Rest assured that the Pacific High crew is feeling pretty grateful and optimistic about 2014.
You know, there's a lot of history of education on this site, and we're just sort of the latest and hopefully greatest iteration of what has gone on here.
In Sitka, I'm Emily Foreman.
Alaska Native leader Bernice Joseph of Fairbanks died of cancer yesterday at age 49. Joseph was a professor and administrator at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. But as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, she maintained strong ties with rural Alaska.
Bernice Joseph's longtime friend Kathy Mayo says Joseph's passion for education was reflected in her devotion to young people and her joy in seeing them succeed.
She loved students, loved developing students, loved sharing their ideas, advancing ideas, and she really put a lot of that to work in the state.
Joseph followed the example of her mother, who earned a college teaching degree while raising a family of seven children by herself in the western Alaska village of Nulato. Joseph earned a bachelor's degree at UAF and then an MBA. She was working on doctoral studies before being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2012. Joseph was a Koyukon Athabascan who was born and raised in Nulato. And Mayo says Joseph worked tirelessly to strengthen Bush communities and their next generation of leaders.
Developing our villages was very important to her, developing leadership in the villages to advance their goals.
Joseph was an assistant professor at UAF's Department of Alaska Native and Rural Development. She was later promoted to vice chancellor for rural, community, and native education. She also served as deputy commissioner of the State Department of Community and Economic Development. She earned many awards, including the Alaska Federation of Natives 2012 Citizen of the Year. But Mayo says Joseph was much more than an academic or leader. She loved to laugh out loud. She loved to get outdoors to run or ski. She loved her family and her people. And Mayo says she believed strongly that those who want to learn about life in the bush must get out into it.
I remember when there was a new faculty who came to the university. Well, she immediately took them out to the village, and they took a snow machine ride from Caltech to Unicoi, because that was her way of showing him what Village Alaska was like.
Several events are scheduled over the next couple of days in memory of Joseph, including morning and evening gatherings today at the Chief David Salmon Tribal Hall downtown. A memorial service will be held Thursday morning at the Tribal Hall before Joseph is returned to Nulato, where she'll be laid to rest. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropekin on Alaska, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Emily Foreman in Sitka, and Tim Ellis in Delta. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions are important members of the state's workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are succeeding in the workplace. The trust encourages Alaska employers to consider ways in which trust beneficiaries and their unique skills can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.